I'm very, very excited. You can tell if my voice is trembling, it's because I got a call saying, would you like to talk to Sapphire about the kid? I know it's not the kind of thing you do. And I said, what do you mean? What kind of thing do I do? What are you talking about? Oh, you read it and see. It might not be your kind of thing. So I went and I read Push. And, you know, after I finished wiping my tears away, I thought even more so, what are they talking about? This really is great literature, not just something that has been made into a movie. This is the story of the future of America. We've allowed maybe two generations of people to go without sufficient education. We've lost the ability in America to transmit our language and our culture. I mean, how selfish in a certain way. But then comes Sapphire with a book that says, language is yours. A child can be taught. And I was crying and crying. I called them up and said, I can't wait. Would you send her? Could we do our first public event with her? I'm so thrilled and honored. This book, The Kid, which, by the way, is on sale in the back of the room, and I hope you'll all pick it up because it's really a trip. It's a harrowing trip, but a wondrous one. It's a journey. It's about that child that so many people wanted to know about at the end of Push. His name is Abdul Jamal Lewis Jones. He's Precious's son. And the book begins on the day of Precious's funeral. I don't want to disappoint anyone, but it happens the four page one, Precious has died of AIDS. This is a writer, not a popular masseuse or massager of public taste. A real writer knows that when you give a character AIDS, that character at that time was going to die. And so it's part of the reality, part of the art of this book, that this boy, Abdul, is going to grow up without his loving mother, without the extraordinary woman who came to be so empathetic and so large. If you ask me, as far as I'm concerned, what Precious is what used to be called a large, round character. And I don't mean her weight. I mean her depth, her richness of presence, the fact that Sapphire invented a character large enough to be a Shakespearean character. She lives with me. After I finished the book, I kept imagining her, hearing her voice. I think I'd seen her all my life and never heard her speak, never knew what she was like until I read Push. And now The Kid continued my own education into what it's like for a child to be born without a mother after age 9. You know, she raises him, she gives him books to read, she tells him how loved he is, and then, you know, cut off from that incredible embrace that he's had with his mother for his life, he's set loose into a system that's not hospitable to him. And we're going to follow him through every level of hell before he comes out knowing who he is. And I'd like you to join me in welcoming the great Sapphire.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction, Michael. I'm going to start reading from the very first chapter or section. The kid is divided into four sections, each section begins with an epigraph. This section is titled "I'm Nine," and the epigraph comes from Flannery O'Connor's "Wise Blood." And I'm going to read the epigraph, and then I will begin to read from the text. Where you come from is gone. Where you thought you were going to never was there. And where you are is no good unless you can get away from it. Wake up, little man. Rita's voice is coming under the covers at me. It's warm under the covers. Smell good like Rita and clean like sheets. I curl up tighter, squeeze my eyes shut, and go back to sleep. In the dream, it's Mommy's birthday party, and she's holding me in her arms, kissing me and dancing with me. Our house is smelling like lasagna, wine, and people, mostly girls sweating and perfume. One girl is smoking weed. Everyone is laughing. Mommy puts me down and goes to open her presents. She's sitting in the blue armchair under the light. All the people have presents in their hands and are holding them out to her. A lady who looks nice, but when she smiles, all her teeth is black, is holding out a pretty present tied with a gold ribbon. No, 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 I want to say, but no words come out my mouth, and Mommy takes the box, and I want to stay asleep even though I know it's a bomb and I'm not dreaming anymore. And if I was dreaming, the bomb would be exploding now, and now that it's too late, my voice would be loud. Abdul, someone is shaking my shoulder. Rita, I squeeze my eyes shut, because when I open them, when I stick my head out from under the covers, my mother will be dead and today will be her funeral. Abdul, Rita, shake my shoulder again. I try to go back to sleep, back to the music, people dancing and our house smelling like lasagna again, but I can't. Nuh-uh, I tell Rita. 5 more minutes, she say. The music is all gone now. There's clear plastic tubes stuck in my mommy's nose. They come out her nose and is taped to the side of her face and go up to a clear plastic bag hanging above her head. Another tube is stuck in her throat. It has tape around it. Her hands got tubes stuck in them too and is all swole up. A machine is going wish rump, wish rump, wish rump. The doctor is from Africa. He talks to me in French sometimes and looks at my homework. He tells jokes, but today he is not joking. She's doing her very best to stay here, little man. He grabs me up in his arms, but God may have other plans. He hands me to Rita, but Rita's skinny, can't hold me, puts me down. He leaves, come back with a stool. Here, stand on this. Come on, little man, your mommy's traveling. I want you to hold her hand. In the hall, the nurse say, I'm very sorry, her condition is critical. Absolutely no visitors. Let them in, doctor say. White woman and lady with long dreadlocks come in and stand behind Rita at the foot of the bed. I'm scared to touch mommy's hands with the tube sticking in them. I look up at the doctor, frog eyes of his red, but he ain't cry. I ain't crying either. He walk over, put my hand on mommy's shoulder. Wake up, mommy. But her eyes don't open. She don't move. Then it's like when you turn down the TV set and can see the pictures moving around, but ain't no sound. It's quiet. Mommy cough, then go like, ah, ah. Her head raises up a little, but her eyes don't open. Then her head falls down. Oh, my God, Rita say. Then the room is all noisy again. Nurse in the hall, talking machine going wish, rump, wish, rump. Somebody dropped something. The doctor picked me up like I'm a baby and carried me out the room. I look back as the door swings shut. The nurse is pulling the tubes out mommy's hands.
Okay, we're going to follow Abdul from age 9 to approximately 19. And the voice that we'll hear from him is mostly inside his own head. This is a novel. It's a dramatic monologue, kind of like Dostoevsky. it might be almost as if you were to read that book, Wise Blood, by Flannery O'Connor, and were to hear the inner thoughts of that itinerant preacher, so convinced that God is going to burn him alive, that what God's sight does is burn. How did you find that inner voice for a character who is so young?
I think one of the things was that, you know, I was already familiar with him when he was in his mother's womb. Like, I knew him. I knew his mother. I knew the milieu that she gave birth to him in. I knew Precious intimately, having created her. And so here comes the son. And while I when he got older, his voice became more of a challenge, a real challenge. But that first chapter, when he's a little boy, I felt like intimately connected to him. And it's interesting, as he kind of escaped from me at times, it was what any adolescent does. You know, they get further and further away from the woman who created them, you know what I mean? And I just kind of had to keep reeling that voice back in.
He really becomes fierce in a way that Precious never does, maybe never can.
Exactly. I think that's it. Precious can't. Precious can't. The tragedy of her life is how much she grew in such a limited context. Her life is her years on earth are going to be limited, number one. And the abuse has truncated her life in many ways. While she overcomes most of it, she's never going to overcome the socioeconomic conditions that have created the abuse in the first place. So she's not going to be able to transcend the poverty and the neighborhood and all of that. So she brings Abdul up in a cocoon almost, and gives him the very best of what she has, but she herself doesn't have much. And so he comes at 9 years old. When we meet him, he's reading better than Precious did at 19. He has the intellectual and the academic skills, you know, at a very young age that she never had. So he's able to decipher the world that he lives in a way that she doesn't.
One of the reasons I think I was crying so hard when I read that first book is that it came so close to my own beliefs that learning language and learning to read saves you from whoever you are, whether you need to be saved from your family or from your economic class or from even from your teachers sometimes, mm-hmm. because they can be pretty scary. Mm-hmm. yeah. And this book really goes beyond that. He can read.
Exactly. Exactly. He can read, and he does read. In Push, reading and literature become the way this child comes into life. But they also are, while Push is a totally modern and urban novel, one of the main themes of the earliest African-American literature, the slave narratives, was this education, you know, this up from slavery. And this often happened through the acquisition of language. We'll see in like something like Frederick Douglass's his autobiography, where he has learned to read and write and is therefore able to write a letter saying, basically emancipating him from the plantation. He writes a letter saying, all you white people who read this letter know that this here slave, I give him permission to go, you know, to go. And he uses that letter to move forward. And in American culture, the position of African Americans has often been, post Reconstruction, was that of economic disenfranchisement. We were never able to, like other immigrants in this country, have strong holdings in business. You know, the minute blacks bought property in the South or got a store after Reconstruction, the Ku Klux Klan or the White Knights of Columbus, as they were being called then, would just come and burn it down. And so we never got that economic foothold, and we still don't have it in a certain kind of way. But what we did learn was that they may burn your house, but they can't take what's in your mind. And so education became really, really important. You know, when they wouldn't let us go to their schools, we built our own schools. You know, when they wouldn't let us go to their medical schools, we built our own schools. And the only way we had entree into mainstream American culture was through education. And so that is part of what we are seeing in the novel push, that it's an extension of that kind of literature. But the kid is a postmodern text. You know what I mean? There are certain things that are assumed, and it's assumed now in the kids' milieu. We have black CEOs, you know what I mean? His quest is not for the same thing that his mother quested for, which was to get language and to redefine herself. He has another quest, and that is going to be kind of the triumph and the tragedy of this novel.
Okay. Now you're entering this character's skin. There's no mistake, this book is channeled through Sapphire. Abdul is speaking, and we get to feel like he is speaking. It doesn't sound like Push anymore. It sounds like the language we're hearing out on the streets, some of it that we wish we weren't hearing. But this language is very strong, and we get the idea right away. At home, Abdul has spoken the language Precious wanted to hear from him. He's mostly been a good boy.
He's been a good boy. Part of him not being no longer being a good boy, of course, is his rage, is the intense rage he feels that all children feel, you know, with the early death of a mother. So he feels utterly abandoned. She has set out a contract for him that all mothers set out. You know, if you're a good boy, XYZ is going to happen. You're going to go to college. You're going to have a good life. None of that is going to happen. And he, at 9 years old, understands. He talks about it. He says, I feel like I drowned. I disappeared. And he understands that the life that he would have had with his mother is no more, and he becomes filled with grief first, and then with rage.
It's also a book of monologues, voices. These are the voices of hell. It's a tour of hell, different levels. The voices of hideous brothers in an orphanage school who have raped Abdul and yet speak with a kind of
eloquence
and holiness, yeah, about mm-hmm. that experience they've shared together, the experience of rape. The language of a woman who arrives in Harlem and is taken to live with her daughter in a whorehouse. This is the great-grandmother of Abdul, in other words, Precious's grandma, and she is speaking a kind of show business pimp. You know, she's met Billie Holiday. She knows the sound of what Harlem sounded like when people were dressed so fancy, when the lace was so beautiful. She, nevertheless, is the foulest-mouthed woman, and now we know, it's such a revelation, where Precious's mother got that tongue from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Zora Neale Hurston, in one of her novels, or it could be one of her letters, I'm not sure, she says, there are years that ask questions, and there are years that give the answers. So in this book, in some ways, Precious herself will ask about Mary, her mother. What kind of story Mama got to do me like she do me? And in this book, when Abdul encounters the great-grandmother, who is Mary's mother, she tells him what has happened, and he gets some understanding of what are the forces that have created him. And, of course, the reader who has read the previous book, although you don't need to have read the previous book to get into the kid, will have some understanding of who and what shaped the woman who was so cruel to Precious Jones.
It's amazing. As I came to read Sapphire's work, it feels to me, you know, she's written two books, really three, of poetry, but it seems as if often in poems they're like rehearsals for the voices in these novels, that this was the way of learning the language of explosive ferocity. In fact, you say, I don't want to write any old villanelle. I want to write the Black Howl.
Right, exactly. I did say that, yeah. And I also think that my real marriage to poetry is to narrative poetry. I was always trying to tell these stories. I don't think I could ever really consider myself a lyric poet, although I admire that type of poetry. So the narrative voice was really important to me. Narrative poets, poets like the master of the dramatic monologue, you know, Browning, and then modern master would be I, the poet in Arizona who wrote Killing Floor. These were monologues that just gripped me. And I really, reading them when I was younger, I said, I want to write like that, you know what I mean? And then in my novels, of course, since I'm coming from a poetic tradition of dramatic monologues, the voice is going to be supreme. I'm assuming that it's not an assumption anymore. You know, as the culture changes, the novelist needs to change. What we don't have, no matter how many reality shows we see, we don't know what the inner soul is thinking. So that's what the novelist can bring. But now all you have to do is, you know, www.google Earth. I don't need to describe Harlem to you. You can see that picture. You know, when novels were being created, we didn't have photography. It was vital that Charles Dickens sit down and describe in intricate detail London. That's no longer necessary. And that's why you get bored reading some of these novels and when they're doing that, because they're doing something that you already have access to. And what we don't have access to, at least I don't have access to, so in some ways I'm doing what Toni Morrison did when she said, I'm writing the novels I need to write. So what I don't have access to is the inner workings of the soul as they are impacted by certain socioeconomic circumstances. And that's what I wanted to give the reader, not a picturesque view of Harlem, or although we do have some pictures of Harlem, not downtown, you know, but we do get those pictures, but that's not primary. The primary thing is the voice, and the voice is primary because it enters into his soul.
Yeah, it happens in this book that not very far from the school where he is taken, where the Catholic brothers are teachers, there's an art center where there's a Langston Hughes show. And the difficulty and danger always of culture is that they take it and put it in a museum someplace where we can't have free, intimate access to it. He's heard the poems. He's even been asked to learn some of them by heart. But there's a poem, for instance, by I, who you just mentioned, A.I., if you've never read her, she died not very long ago.
Last year.
And tragic, you know, surprising death. Mm-hmm. A book came out called Cruelty. It was her first book. Her name, she took the Japanese word for love.
Exactly.
Cruelty by Love. And her poem, The Kid, surprise, appears in her book called Killing Floor, and it begins like this. My sister rubs the doll's face in mud, then climbs through the truck window. She ignores me as I walk around it, hitting the flat tires with an iron rod. The old man yells for me to help hitch the team, but I keep walking around the truck, hitting harder, until my mother calls. I pick up a rock and throw it at the kitchen window, but it falls short. The old man's voice bounces off the air like a ball I can't lift my leg over. I stand beside him waiting, but he doesn't look up, and I squeeze the rod, raise it, his skull splits open. Okay, so what we have is the beginning, I think, because we've had County Cullen, we've had a lot of black poetry that has the love of the black community. This was the opening of Mean, and the opening of Fury and Hatred, and from a woman poet, it was extraordinary to hear. What was that tradition?
I had never read anything like her before. I thought she was utterly daring. She, a little bit about her, she's a African. Her mother was African American and Native American. She basically grew up in Arizona and Oklahoma, and she was obsessed with Japanese culture. You know, she got a degree in Japanese culture, and so one day her mother finally sits her down, and it's kind of obvious when you look at pictures of her, and tells her, you know, basically, Dad was the traveling Japanese salesman who dropped by, and you are half Japanese, So that's kind of how she, you know, her life, and she begins to take on the voices of everyone from in her poetry, from everyone from JFK to you know, to Stalin, to Soviet Jewry, to Native Americans, to Japanese. Warriors. It's amazing. So, and I didn't know that people could do that. You know, I thought that was against the rules. You know, what they were telling me in writing school, write what you know, you know. And so that would always confine you to the little box of who you are or what you have, you know, most intimately observed. And what she was saying is that we could write about anything, and that we could write about what we were observing, and you know, what we were observing when we picked up the paper and read, you know, Mr. Jones has come home and blown everybody's brains out. You know, that could be poetry. You know, that was part of what was happening every day. The kid is a little psychopath, and the epigraph for the second part of the book, which is called, the first part is called I'm Nine, the second part is called Falling. Starts with an epigraph from the kid, which is, I'm 14. I'm a wind from nowhere. I can break your heart. And we are going to follow with that epigraph into that particular chapter, into what is probably going to be some of the darkest moments of Abdul's life.
I'm a wind from nowhere. I can break your heart. It almost seems like it's the abandon hope, all ye who enter here.
Exactly.
We're going to have our hearts broken over and over again in this novel by this wind from nowhere who probably is experimenting with breaking your heart because his mother was so tender-hearted, and look where he is now. So what he is doing, it's sort of like an audition. This boy is going to learn to talk so tough. I remember reading Lenny Bruce's book, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People. And you get the feeling that that's where Abdul is, that these people are modeling themselves in a certain sense. What kind of performance could I give if I went out on stage and performed myself? What would it sound like?
Mm-hmm. And performance is also going to be an important part of this book. You know, his acquisition of language is going to be multifaceted. He's going to learn the language of hate. He's also going to learn the language of love and creation. He is going to be literate. He is going to be, an art African-American young man who's going to be an artist. And he is going to have more than a dual personality. I think there was one Precious, and she had her heart was almost bigger than she was. She was just a good soul. Abdul is who he needs to be when he needs to be it.
I'm going to take a big, big risk. Now, this book is full of language of every kind, but we're not children and we walk on the streets, so we've heard it all. Let's not be foolish. I'm going to ask you to open the book to any page and start to read.
Okay. All right. I'll do that if it is logical. If not, then I'll find another page. But if it makes
by logical, we mean just that you'll be able to follow.
Yeah, that you would be able to. Okay. This is I'm going to just turn back a little bit. One of the things that Abdul has learned to do and learned to do well is deny and to lie. He's acutely ashamed of the fact that his mother has died of AIDS, as are most children whose mothers and fathers have died of AIDS. And here he has he is in an encounter with his dance teacher. And they are trying to decipher. They are taking him home after he has collapsed in dance class, and they're trying to figure out what's up with this kid. So they say something like, "And by now he's changed his name." And the dance teacher's name is Amina.
She teaches an African American dance class.
Yeah,
and it's kind of amazing because the only thing that all of the systems of welfare and child care and everything else, the best they managed to do is to get him into an African dance class.
Okay. So they're taking him home now, and they're wondering what has happened to him. And the boyfriend, Amina's boyfriend, asks, "Hey, how old are you, man? Believe me, the ball is in your court. We ain't going to say nothing to nobody. Did those Catholic freaks beat you up? Them homos make a move on you?" Ibrahim is all beside himself now. "How old are you, JJ?" Amina asks. 13. "Whew, you look older, way older." "It's true, JJ, you look older than 13. If people, I don't know. So what happened at the Catholic school? Did they move on you?" "Something like that," I tell her. I fought back. But they fucked me up and brought me to Harlem Hospital. Then from there they take me to my relatives, who is real old." "Real old? Where's your mother and father, JJ?" "My mother died in a car accident, and my father got killed in the war." "What war?" Ibrahim asks. "I'm not sure." "Well, who are these old relatives?" "I don't know." "You don't know? I wish Ibrahim would shut up and not ask me no more fucking questions." "Well, JJ, just tell us who these old people are before we take you there." "Amina," Ibrahim says, "take it from me. We ain't getting the whole story. I don't know what it is, but we ain't getting it. They're talking about me like I'm not here or 3 years old or something. Look at him. It's obvious he's been traumatized. It's not his fault. JJ, please tell us, to the best of your ability, who these old people are." Amina sounds like she's in a soap opera or some shit. "Well, after my mom and dad died, I got took to St. Ilanthus School for Boys because my only living relatives couldn't be found. Then after I got kicked out of St. Ilanthus, they found some of them relatives." "Amina, we ain't hearing the full story. And we're not going to, Ibrahim, at least not tonight."
Now, those was, or, see, those were external, but most of this book, as I mentioned, is taking place in this boy's head. Now, he's been exposed, he's been resistant, but he's been exposed to the idea that African spirits can enter him when he dances. He's been exposed to the idea that the more expressive he can become, the more powerful an artist he'll be.
Exactly.
And so what he does, you see, is scare himself. He blows himself up with the winds of horror. He becomes like an exterminating angel or a vengeful demon. And unlike Precious, who has plenty of people to punish her, Abdul punishes himself. He mutilates himself several times in the book. So we kind of get the vision of the cutter. Yes?
Yeah.
Tell me, when you sat down to write these sections, where you have to write a prose as huge and explosive as this boy's dancing, because he wows people. He dances himself until he faints, you know? He brings himself, he leaves the body. How do you do it? Because you do it a bunch of times.
Yeah. I think, you know, every artist has their own means of entering into material. For me, I had to continue to write in the way that I wanted to write, you know, and started some of it in Push. I had to really learn how to compartmentalize. I think Bill Clinton brought that word to our consciousness, you know. Now I'm in the blue room, now I'm with Monica Lewinsky. Those words, those worlds never emerge, you know. So for me, it was like, in some ways, the analogy you gave earlier, like hell, like he's, so I'm the tour guide through this hell, but my job is to make sure that the reader is not destroyed, that they keep keep seeing a certain kind of light, and not a light that is going to blind them or burn out the retina or something like that, but they keep being able to travel through this darkness, or there's no use in writing if the reader is going to be so destroyed or disgusted. So my job is to create a space for myself every morning for 3 or 4 hours where I too will guide myself through that darkness, and I'm able to do it because I've made that promise that at noon, I'm through. You know, I just close the book and go be normal. Go be, you know, the cheerful teacher or whatever the role is. But I leave that behind, knowing that, you know, I'm not going to go insane in the writing. The reader is not going to go insane in the reading. And as I've had to tell people, this is not autobiographical. This is not nonfiction. You know, Abdul does not exist. We talked about that earlier. You know, Precious is a created character, and so you know I can, and I'm an artist, and I'm trying to create in the tradition of I. You know, I reread Dostoevsky, and Raskolnikov will take the axe and put it under his jacket and go do a horrific thing, and that's in the beginning. But we will stay with him for, you know, 300 or 400 pages because we're interested in his thoughts. We're interested in how the environment will impact upon this young man who has created this crime, how he will be broken by the crime, how he will be resurrected by the crime.
I want to ask you something, if I can find the words for it, that I've never asked anyone before, but I think it's important and I think it's part of art. As I read The Kid, I felt like I was being put in touch with those moments of terror that I had when I was a child, when something quite normal would happen, but no one had told me it would happen. No one had prepared me. No one had said I was going to ejaculate, so I thought something had broken in me. You know, we all live in the world of the body, and we're not given adequate instruction.
Exactly.
And there's a certain kind of, I can only describe it as unholiness, that happens in every child's life. And if a parent isn't there to say, no, you're not broken, the devil doesn't have you, this is one of the things we go through. You take your reader to those places unfailingly.
Right.
The other writers I know who do that, Dostoevsky does it regularly. Mm-hmm. You know, Dostoevsky was himself an epileptic, a gambling addict, you know. He was not, I mean, the great, one of the three great writers of Russian literature was not a man you would want to know.
Right.
For him, it was often autobiographical. For you, not. But how do you get there to the place of violation?
Mm-hmm. I think first, I want to be honest. It's like you prepare yourself, you know, like a dancer or a musician. You're learning your craft. I can't say sometimes how I get there. You know what I mean? Sometimes I just end up there. What I can say is that it has taken. I remember during the writing of this book, the feeling was. Not that I would never write another book, because I'm starting to write another book now, but that I didn't know if I would ever write another book, and I wanted everything to go into this book. So there were a lot of issues around sexuality and the body and stuff that I've been wanting to explore, and that actually might have been better explored with a female character in another book. But I said, this book, do it, make it, put it in this book. You don't know how Abdul feels, but this is what Einstein told us. He said, imagination is more important than knowledge. And, you know, Emily Dickinson said the same thing, you know, the mind is wider than the sky because the mind can encompass the sky. And so I have that. That is what I have. I'm not a news reporter, even though I respect journalism, I am actively engaging my imagination to enter into the life of a boy. And I didn't want to skip. I wanted to connect all the dots. You know, I used the same thing, the same imagination to enter into the life of his great grandmother as this woman working in the whorehouse. I used the same imagination, and this was really a risk, because there's a way that black literature can get cut off from other literature, and you can get away with other things, because then if the critic says, that's not accurate, you could always say, well, you don't know anything about black people. That is, it is accurate. So I was really, at one point, he's dancing, and he in his dance troupe, and he falls in love with a young Asian American girl, and I was just thinking, I can't write her story. I better turn her black. But he kept saying, well, this is who I'm in love with, you know. And so I had to write her story. So it was a tremendous risk, because, of course, I could be very wrong, you know. But I just felt that this is what the same risk that I asked my readers to take in entering this text. There's no comfort here. But there is transformation, and you can know that I took those risks too. That I went, I entered unknowing into many places, and maybe made some mistakes. But I don't think that mistakes preclude art. That art is not perfection, you know. And I allowed myself. I said, well, I might be wrong, but I need to write my story.
And this is why I love you. I mean, you have to pardon me. I do. Because you see, I've never said this before. I always held myself back from writing because I felt that if it wasn't great, I didn't want to do it at all. that it had better be great. You know, Keats, I think, said, unless it comes as leaves to the tree, it had better not come at all. But I think...
You see what happened to him.
Yeah.
See how long he lasted. I mean, he was great for a little while.
But I think for you, the point is not so much being great, but putting it all there, every bit of it.
Exactly. I never considered myself great, or I wasn't even ever sure I was really good. But what I was sure of was I had something, like Martha Graham says, that everybody has something unique, that I had something to give. And this was where I was going to, and I chose this medium. I certainly, there was nothing in my, I did well in school academically, Dean's List or whatever, but there was nothing really in my background to tell me that writing was going to be it. But it's like I knew as an African-American young woman, especially in the time that I grew up, that anything I chose, they were going to be there to say, you're not good enough. You know, if you want to dance, well, before Arthur Mitchell started the Dance Theater Harlem, they were telling black people don't have the body for ballet. You know, so you just go study ballet and they tell you don't have the body. You can't change your body, you know what I mean? You go to, you know, be a nuclear physicist and they're saying you don't have the IQ to do this, or you don't have the depth of, you can't write like Proust. Well, who the fuck can write like Proust but Proust, you know what I mean? But so there's always the naysayers. So I knew that I just had to throw down. And that while I may not be able to create something great, I would be able to create something that was mine and something that was unique and something that was different and also something that was necessary, you know, that what I had to say would mean something to at the very least to the children like Precious, who had never seen anything except, you know, Goldilocks and Little Red Riding Hood and places that they didn't exist. At least they had a place in print where they now existed.
That's really beautiful. I'm going to open this to the audience. I think we could, you and I, talk for hours and hours, and I would love to.
We have.
So are there questions out there? Please raise your hands.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm really curious. When you were writing Push, when did you have a sense that you were going to write The Kid?
I didn't have the sense while I was writing Push that I was going to write The Kid, but I had already had some inklings that, you know, first in my notes, as I was talking about earlier, I had planned for Precious to have a baby girl, but instead she had Abdul. So that was a beginning right there, that the story that I was going to be pulled to write a story maybe that I wasn't ready for, you know, to write the story of a young male. And then there were a couple of incidents that kind of like little clues. One was I was with a where I work at the writer's room in Manhattan with a really brilliant biographer and scholar, and so she was making a joke, you know, about, you know, kind of an inside writer's joke about publishers and you know, the follow-up, and she says, yeah, you know what they're going to want out of you now, Sapphire? I said, what? She said, the son of Push. And then everybody was just cracking up, except me. I just didn't laugh, you know what I mean, and it just, that stayed there. And then another thing happened that kind of was that froze me. But then I had something that really, really touched my heart, and I got a letter. People would write to me in care of the publisher, and then the publisher would send me letters. And I got a letter in this kind of doily type paper that older African American women write on, and that my grandmother used to write notes on when she would put the, you know, the $3 in the envelope, you know, like the $3 was going to save you from poverty, but they would send it anyway. And so in the letter, the woman wrote me, and she was ill, and she was unable to get out of her house much, and she couldn't go to the library, and so the only way she could get books was from the traveling the bookmobile. So the bookmobile had come, and it had brought her Push, and she had read Push, and she wrote me to tell me that she just could not, she couldn't sleep at night worrying about Precious. And I'm so worried about the little boy. Whatever happened to the little boy? I just can't rest without knowing what happened to Abdul. So I had to write her back to tell her that Precious was a created character. So therefore, nothing had happened that hadn't happened in the book, and what had happened in the book hadn't really happened, and that the Abdul that she was thinking about, a flesh and blood child, did not exist. But that was like another seed in my heart that this was a story that needed to be told, I thought.
Okay.
Yeah, we hear you.
I first just wanted to say that I think you are a singular talent, and that your work, in particular this novel, is revelatory and deserves every award that we have for fiction writers. So thank you.
Thank you.
My question is, your novels in particular deal with so much that is political, race and sexuality and incest and education and poverty and welfare. And I don't know if I've ever read anybody who deals with those issues with no judgment at all. And you seem to, every time when you bring the reader to a place where we're tempted to judge, you just like smash it and mm-hmm. obliterate that and bring mm-hmm. us somewhere else. And I wonder how can you deal with those things without any judgment? And how do you tolerate the fact that your readers are going to be making judgments about those kind of things when they read your work?
Well, one of the things that happens actually is because I've really suspended judgment myself, is that a lot of times the readers don't make judgments. You know, I remember more than one time, and it was kind of, I never felt totally comfortable with it, but people felt comfortable telling me that. A reporter and then a woman in the audience after reading Push, she said, "I will never, ever look at a fat black woman in the same way as I did before." So, and you know, it wasn't necessarily, I certainly didn't write the book for that reason, to change her view of overweight people of color. But there was a way that what she was saying is, I have judged these people. I have judged these people, and I have looked at them and looked past them and decided that they are the way they are because of something that they can totally control, and I am the way I am, beautiful, and so forth, because of will and just a strength of character. And she, by entering into Precious's life, had to drop some judgment. So I think that's part of it. I think that there's a way that some things, that people's ideas of poverty and certain things are so deeply entrenched, I think that some people, even no matter what I do, will walk away with judgments. But I do think that there's a way of especially in Push, where so many different facets of poverty and the welfare system are shown, you really see the mother who is horrendously abusing the system. And so people say, well, that's a reason you're showing this stereotype. But we also see Precious, who uses the system to tremendous benefit. Everything that she does and that benefits her, from the school, the alternative education, to the halfway house, all of that are the positive facets of welfare that every young person who is deprived of family support between the ages of 14 to 18 if we don't want them to end up lifelong residents in mental hospitals or prisons. They need that input from the government, and they would be getting it in other countries, in some other countries, you know.
Oh, good. Come on.
Way in the back.
Yeah.
Hi. I can't even tell you what you've meant to me and all the lawyers who represent the Preciouses of the world in dependency court.
Thank you for your work.
Well, what you did and what you're continuing to do is kind of amazing. But I just wanted to know, we have, you know, so many clients who are precious, and they don't give their kids what Abdul got in his first 9 years. And then we have some who do, but it's not appreciated, or because they use pot a couple of times, and they have the history they have, their kids get taken away anyway.
Exactly, yeah.
And what you just said about the money is so much at the heart of it, because then they basically have to buy their children back, because they have to spend $25 a week going to, you know, classes, you know, one class, and then they have to spend 35 a week going to another class, and sometimes they're ordered to four or five of these a week. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In any event, I want to take a message back to, you know, all the lawyers I supervise from you, because you're kind of a hero around dependency court, and if you could say something to them, what would it be?
I think one of the things I would say to all professionals and paraprofessionals who are working like in the legal and educational system is that it's vital that we work on the level that you're working with the individual client, because without that, that person is lost. But the other thing is, they are part of the reason they are lost is because the laws of the land require you to defend them. And so one of the things we need to be doing is really looking at certain issues about parenting, about custody, and so that they are not, they don't continue to come up with the same, I mean, you know, two-parent nuclear families with a mom and dad, they don't lose custody of their kid if there's a joint in the front seat of the car. You know, why is it that an impoverished woman of color is going to lose custody because she's driving with a can of beer open? You know what I mean? So the same things that upper middle class and middle class people can do, these women end up with their lives devastated by doing. And that's, you know, that has to, there has to be a way that those laws impact people equally or are just banished, I think.
Now, you all get to talk to Sapphire over at the book signing table, and I hope you all pick up the book. But two more questions, and we'll go. Yeah.
But I'd like to ask Sapphire if we could hear a poem of hers.
I've got the books here. Which one do you want? Here you go.
Okay, a poem. All right.
Hey, thank you for asking that.
Trying to find you. One of the things I do is write long poems. I didn't want to give you a long, long poem. Okay. This is a poem called California Dreaming. California Dreaming. Was I this lonely as a child? My bones are lonely now. Pointing to a white flag with a brown bear on it, the teacher tells us this is our state flag. In my class, everybody is born in America. We pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. The teacher tells us the sequoia is our state tree, that they are the tallest trees in the world. I wonder about a boy I knew in kindergarten, so short he had trouble climbing into his seat. Is he lonely now, like a Ferris wheel abandoned in the rain? As a child, I liked those things, Ferris wheels, cotton candy, crinolines, the Mouseketeers. I wonder, was my brother always lonely ever? Was he lonely in the park when the killer came? When God erased his name, could he feel it? Was he lonely? Was he cold the night, the years he walked alone? Did he think about his childhood? Did he think he was insane? Did the voices riding in the wind comfort him or drive him like a shepherd over concrete collecting aluminum cans? Did he breathe his own blood like a blanket finally covering him? Can we lay down together now like I always wanted since I am so lonely and he is bones? The golden poppy is our state flower. California is the second largest state in the union. The teacher, where is she now? Is she old, dead? Did she die from drinking or complete 25 years of talking to lonely, desperate old people in baby bodies about the kinds of clouds, arithmetic, verbs, George Washington? Did she know we would end up rainy eyes, homeless, wandering through state forests, trying to find the trees she taught us were ours?
We'd be crazy not to end there, so I'm going to thank you and to ask you to give your questions to Sapphire at the signing table there. First of all, I want to hear the loudest applause you're capable of, and thanks to Sapphire.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.